Well, if you listen to this show regularly, you probably figured out that I'm kind of a Civil War buff. I've probably read hundreds of books on this subject. But you know what? There's always something new to learn about that period in our nation's history. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And thanks, too, to my guest today, Thomas Fleming, for joining us. He's an historian, a historical novelist with a special interest in the American Revolution, written more than 50 books, both fiction and nonfiction, and his most recent book is a fascinating one. It's titled A Disease in the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War. And he joins us today by phone. Really great to have him with us today. Have you studied the Civil War? Do you ever get the feeling that the story was oversimplified? Maybe you're a Civil War buff, or maybe you're fascinated about this period in our nation's history. I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments today at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can join us there with your questions or with your comments. Thomas Fleming, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Larry. I'm delighted to get a chance to talk to someone who probably knows more about the Civil War than I do.
Well, no, I doubt that very much. I really enjoyed your book, though.
Well, thank you.
It was really interesting. I think it might even... For me, one of the really amazing things, after all I've read about the Civil War, to learn anew that it was ours is the only country to fight to end slavery.
Yes, this is a little known fact that we killed, we now think perhaps a million men to end slavery, and every other major country in the world ended it peacefully.
It just absolutely boggles my mind, and that's why I think what makes your book so fascinating. Where does you call it a disease in the public mind? Talk about where that come from.
Yeah, I had not really heard the term, certainly the full term, a disease in the public mind, until I read it when I was writing an article about the trial of John Brown, and I'd also written another article about Brown's capture and so forth, and the President James Buchanan said there is nothing that can be done, meaning about Brown and the people who financed him to go down and really start a race war in the South. There's nothing that can be done. It is a disease in the public mind. Now Buchanan was a Democrat and intensely pro-Southern. He had more Southern friends than he had friends in Pennsylvania, where he came from. But the phrase just resonated in my mind. And then, of course, as you mentioned, I have spent a lot of time studying the American Revolution, and the phrase public mind started clicking. And I went back into various books that I have, and I found that it was a very common term in the 18th century. Washington, Jefferson, Madison, they all talked about the public mind. And what does that mean, I asked myself in the widest possible terms. And it really means it's not public opinion that they're talking about. They're talking about some fundamental ideas that sort of connect a group of people or a state or a whole region to the world as they see it, and this is what Buchanan was talking about when he said that the people that John Brown and the people who sent him were victims of a disease in the public mind. They had allowed or not maybe not allowed, but slavery had become a religious as well as a political issue to them, and they hated Southerners as just because they were Southerners and because some of them owned slaves. And and then the more I began to see what a disease means, and we're talking about a psychological disease here, where does it go off when we're saying the Southerners were detestable because they owned slaves? Well, the disease immediately becomes apparent because only 6% of the Southerners.
That's amazing.
60 owned slaves.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing a figure.
Go ahead. No. That's
well, that number, when I saw that number, I thought, oh my goodness, if only 6% of the Southerners owned slaves, how did it become such an issue for everybody who didn't own slaves?
Yes, Larry, and that's where I made my next step in deciding to write this book. I began to think, well, what was the disease in the public mind that would inspire all of these non-slave owners in the South to go out and risk their lives? I mean, they took terrific casualties. So anybody reads about Gettysburg Malvern Hill, which, of course, is an unbelievable slaughter in 1862, Southern slaughter, I mean, and so forth. When you read these the terrible casualties they took, what was it? What were they afraid of? And that's where I began to realize that there was something that the South feared. And I began to read editorials in Southern newspapers and their reaction to Brown in editorial after editorial as I read my way through the Southern papers was meaning the Northerners, want to make another Santo Domingo of us. That phrase was repeated again and again. So I had to say, well, wait a minute, Santo Domingo, what does that mean exactly? And the next thing you know, I was trending back into the life of Thomas Jefferson and finding out that in 1801, when he became president, he was visited by a French diplomat who was representing revolutionary France, and he wondered if Jefferson would approve a French invasion of Saint-Domingue, as they called it, which was the French part of the island of Santo Domingo. They had had a revolution there, and it was now being ruled by a very talented black man who had created an interracial society, some whites and mostly blacks, and they had gotten rid of slavery. When I realized that this was trouble, a very big trouble, to race through the story, what happened was the French sent an army with the complete approval of Jefferson, and the army began to slaughter the blacks who resisted them, because the next thing you know, at first they didn't say this, but then it soon became apparent that they intended to reinstitute slavery. Napoleon was now in charge, and so the next thing you know, strange things began happening to the French army. They just whole regiments started to collapse, and we discovered the invisible ally that the U.S. had in this, America had in this, it was a war that involved us, really. It was the little mosquito that creates yellow fever.
Yeah.
And the French army was destroyed by this whole, by this little creature. And the next thing you know, they had to evacuate. They just abandoned after a year and a half of unbelievable, as I say, slaughter. They evacuated, and then the only guy left standing was a burly black general. And he marched his army across Haiti, and he killed every white man, woman, and child.
Yeah.
And when this news reached America, it sent a shiver of terror through the whole South, the fear of a race war. And President Jefferson was so appalled that he had his son-in-law, who was a congressman, come into the Congress and announce that he was introducing a resolution that would make it impossible for any American to have any political connection with Haiti. We're never going to recognize their independence or anything like it. And then the son-in-law, whose name was John Epps, he stood there in the House of Representatives and he looked around and he said, "Is there anyone so base as would object to this resolution?"
Yeah.
And nobody said a word. And the resolution went through, and Haiti was left to drift down the decades. The next president who had anything to do with Haiti, who sent a representative as an ambassador, was Abraham Lincoln in 1862. For 58 years, we never had any official connection with Haiti because they were this living image of this fear of the race war that the South was terrified of.
And Jefferson was really, and Jefferson escaped without any criticism even.
Jefferson acquired a Teflon outfit when he bought Louisiana. Okay. He could do no wrong after that. The story of Sally Hemings disappeared. Everything that you could find fault with, a lot of people did find fault with him, but not a majority. He was worshipped because he had created this vast empire of liberty, as he called it, out there in the West, that gave everyone the hope of having his own farm and being semi-independent and all that. And so he got away with it. He really did it.
He was a fascinating character, and how this whole issue of slavery was addressed in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution.
Yes.
Talk about his thinking in that.
Jefferson loathed the idea of slavery, and he absolutely made that so clear in the Declaration of Independence. He accused the king of trying to destroy the United States by introducing slavery into America and so forth and so forth. But when it came to the actual reality of slavery, he had a pseudoscience attitude. Jefferson thought there's a famous line by Jack Kennedy. He said that he was talking about one time when he had all sorts of distinguished people in the White House advising him on this and that, and technology and politics and so forth. And he said, never was there so much talent in the White House at one time, except when Thomas Jefferson dined alone.
Yeah.
There is the myth of Jefferson. Yeah? And so he decided, but his pseudoscience, scientific study of blacks convinced him that they were inferior to whites and they could never be freed because they had so much resentment because of slavery. So he was basically totally opposed, or secretly you might say, to ever freeing the slaves.
Yeah.
And this attitude was communicated, you might say, under the table to an awful lot of people in the South.
Thomas Fleming, our guest today, he is the author of the book, A Disease in the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War. Hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. Have you studied the Civil War? Questions about it? Are you a buff? What fascinates you about this period of our history? 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. If you have a question, do it that way. Or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller. Jason Butler, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Want to let you know that 3 weeks from today, Tuesday, July 22nd, at the same time, Jeff Shera will join us. He's going to be talking about his new Civil War novel. It's called The Smoke at Dawn. And if you want to read it before then, we can treat the show sort of like a book club of sorts. Right now, we're talking with Thomas Fleming. Tom has latest book out, A Disease in the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can post your questions or your comments there. And we will take some questions now, as a matter of fact. Let's turn to, can we get Ray on here? I will hold off for just a second. And let's try once more here. There we go. Ray and Rhinelander, thank you for calling. Ray, are you there? No. So, for some reason, we're having a little technical difficulty here. We'll take care of that in just a minute. I think, along with Jefferson, Tom was, you know, well before the Civil War, here is somebody who was kind of was against slavery.
Yes.
And that even goes back further. I mean, Washington, George Washington kind of, as you say, went the whole gamut. He started out owning slaves, and by the end, he had changed his mind.
He was the Marquis de Lafayette convinced Washington slavery was immoral and detestable and could not be tolerated in a republic. And Washington, he several times when he was president, came very close to freeing the slaves he owned at Mount Vernon, and urging the rest of the country to do the same thing. He was very strongly opposed. But there's all kinds of quotes which I have in the book of him discussing this with various people and so forth. But he saw that the overriding principle for Washington as president and as leader of the country, really, in every respect, was the Union. He saw that if we split up, whether the cause was slavery or some other issue, and we broke into several groups of states, we'd wind up just like Europe, fighting wars with each other and decimating the whole idea of a creative empire of free men. You know, he didn't do it. But when after he left the presidency in the last year of his life, he drew up his will, and he did free all the slaves that he owned at Mount Vernon. Unfortunately, about half of them were owned by his wife, Martha, and they were called dower slaves. She had inherited them from her husband, and she couldn't free them even if she wanted to, which she didn't, incidentally. And so it added an imperfection to Washington's freeing of his slaves. But he freed 123 black men and women. And the amazing thing is, if you read his will, it's one of the most interesting things I've ever read. He went into the individual character and personality of each one of these black men and women and suggested the education they could have to be productive and independent people when they were free. It was an amazing example of a man who really cared about these people and wanted them to be free and play a role in America. I call Washington the forgotten emancipator.
Yeah, and you also say he was not successful in even convincing his own relatives.
No, Martha, his grandchildren, they really are step grandchildren. You know, he didn't convince any of them. It shows that this was a really difficult problem. There's no doubt about it, and it wasn't going to be solved by waving a wand or anything like that, or even waving the hand of a famous man like Washington. And he was aware of that, and that's why he backed off saying anything dramatic about it. And yet there are other men in the Virginia's catalog of anti-slavery people who are also remarkable, and one of my favorites is Thomas Jefferson Randolph, who was Jefferson's grandson, his oldest grandson. He was a big guy like Jefferson, but he was also husky. Jefferson was a tall beanpole, but Thomas Jefferson Randolph was a brute. He must have weighed like 250 pounds, and he was an idealist of awesome proportions. When Jefferson died, he was, in our money today, he was $1 million in debt. And Thomas Jefferson Randolph vowed that he would pay back that debt to the last cent. And for the next 25 years after Jefferson's death, Thomas Jefferson Randolph and his wife and their children lived very severely controlled lives from the point of view of spending money, because he took every cent that he could make from his farms to pay off Jefferson's debt. And then in the 1830s, he embarked on what he hoped would make up for the failure of Jefferson to be a leader against slavery. And he got into the Virginia legislature, and he introduced a bill for the gradual emancipation of slavery. Okay. And it caused a huge uproar. It's one of the most interesting parts of my book. All kinds of distinguished Virginians admitted that slavery was a curse. It was the most horrible thing that they had in their lives, and they could do. They were said they'd do anything to get rid of it, but they couldn't overcome this fear of a race war.
That was just an absolutely amazing. I want to give Ray and Rhinelander a chance now to join us.
Sure.
Ray, hi. Thank you for calling.
Are we on now?
Yes, we are.
Okay. I'd like to make a comment on a Civil War history on the economics of the tariff and tax on the goods. You had the industrialized North that was evolving, and you had the agricultural South. Now, the two were at odds with this tariff tax that the North was going to put on the South for their goods. And then, of course, that fell in line with the political structure and the philosophies of slavery. And I would like your guests to clarify that. That's been on the docket for many years about, you know, how did the Civil War start? Was it pre-tariff tax, economic, et cetera? And I'll take it off the air. Thank you very much for being on.
Well, Thomas Fleming, that your book is about how it got going.
To some extent it is. We certainly deal with it in the book. First of all, the North had a completely screwed-up idea, the abolitionist part of the North, at any rate. They all weren't abolitionists. The abolitionists really were. They never were more than 20% of the population. They had a completely screwed-up. They published in newspapers and essays and so forth that slavery was destroying the South. They were the poorest section of the country, and they were all going to starve if we didn't rescue them from this plague, da-da-da-da-da. This was absolute baloney. Of the 10 wealthiest states in the Union in 1860, six of them were Southern. Slavery was a hugely successful system from an economic point of view. They had really worked it out, and the North was buying, and the British were buying tons and tons and tons of cotton that they were producing, and so that was. A complete fallacy and this only intensified the attitude of the South towards the North, that they don't understand us, they don't like us, they're making up stories about us. It's a myth. We're not that way. And then, of course, in the book, I also get into the fact that as the South became more and more profitable in the 1850s, freedom started to infiltrate the Southern, the slave system. They started in many, many plantations, they started paying the slaves to produce a better crop, particularly when they were raising non-cotton crops. Another big factor in the whole thing was that nobody has ever really thought about before was about 70% of all the Southern farms were run by black overseers. And I have a chapter in the book called The Real Uncle Tom and the Unknown South that he helped create. And that's all about how these black men, they had talent. They knew how to be leaders. And that they were rewarded with extra food and sometimes with money so forth. As they acted as the overseers. And I've got quotes in the book of saying a white owner saying this black man who's been my overseer for the last 5 years, he's better than any white overseer I ever had. He's one of the most precious memories of members of my plantation family. Blah, on and on and on. So there's a whole reality out there that I don't think we understand about the South and the North in this psychological relationship.
Yeah. Mike in New Holstein has a question. Mike, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. A quick question and a follow-up. The first question is, I understand the New York Stock Exchange was originally founded on the basis of Wall Street, where they did trade slaves. I don't know if that's a rumor or if you can verify that or not, and then I have a follow-up question.
Well, yeah, yes, I think any place of business where they had, you have to be careful saying the word founded. But slavery was part of the business of New York State. 14% of New York State citizens, if you want to call them that, they couldn't vote, but 14% of New York State's population were black slaves. They had one of the highest percentages of any northern state. And of course there was, they would be buying and selling slaves in various places where there was lots of money to exchange hands and loans could be taken out and so forth and so forth, because slaves were worth a great deal of money. It was not a small matter to buy a slave or sell one.
Okay. Follow-up question has to do with the money factor. Are there any existing companies that might have had their founding based on the slave trade, for example, mutual companies or insurance companies?
The northern textile industry was using tons and tons of cotton produced by the slaves. There's no doubt about it. This didn't bother any. It bothered some people, of course. Yes, the people who were violently anti-slavery, the abolitionists. But there was a very definite, shall we say, relationship between the money class of that part of the North and the South. They weren't separate countries by any means. That too is a fact of life. That's all there is to it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Mike. You can join in too. We're talking today with Thomas Fleming, historian and historical novelist as well. He is visiting with us about his latest book, A Disease in the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War. I think most people who thought about the Civil War and have written about it assumed that the reasons and the underpinnings for it were much later than Thomas Fleming has found in his research. In fact, it goes back quite a long time, maybe 100 years before the Civil War, the stage was set for...
Oh, definitely, yes. There were people, John Woolman, for instance, who was a... I'm from New Jersey. I've always felt sort of a special feeling. I've always had a special feeling for John Woolman. He was a Quaker. And he just felt slavery was wrong. Quakers were not great analysts. They just, what vibrated in their souls meant so much to them. And John Woolman just decided that slavery was wrong, and he started traveling around the country telling people this and asking them to think about it and meditate on it and so forth. And he was amazingly successful in some places, in Rhode Island, for instance. People freed their slaves after they talked to him and so forth. And then he went to England, and he created a sensation over there, because at this point the English had over 1 million slaves in their West Indian islands. And John Woolman... upset them too, you know, mm-hmm. with his earnest, pleading tone and his lack of accusation. He never said that a man who owned slaves was evil or anything like that. He was the opposite of the abolitionists who came 100 years later denouncing and vilifying. And incidentally, Larry, we might make a little leap here.
Yeah.
From Woolman to what happened with Thomas Jefferson Randolph? His plea or his bill to try to persuade the Virginia to start beginning to free slaves. They were the biggest state. They had almost half of all the slaves in the Union were in Virginia. And this would have been a huge thing if he could have persuaded the Virginia legislature to do something. And he lost by only 5 votes when it came to a vote in the legislature. And so he immediately ran for office again, and he beat a vowed slaveholder, and he was ready to launch his campaign again, but he found that nobody would talk to him in the 2 or 3 years that had elapsed between that vote And when he began to try to renew his plea for a gradual emancipation, the abolitionists had deluged Virginia with pamphlets and copies of northern newspapers denouncing anyone who owned slaves as a loathsome rapist and this and of that. And the whole idea of vilifying the southern white man, as Thomas Jefferson Randolph put it later in his life, had become such a way of life among the abolitionists in the North that it was hopeless. And he gave up on his campaign, and that was the last time anyone really in the South had a rational discussion of possibly ending slavery.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? You know, you write about John Brown, of course, and you set the stage for the book by talking about John Brown's raid.
Yes, the one who got me into this whole book. There's no doubt about that, yes.
Yeah, that was such a pivotal, and he was such a... What? I don't know how you did. How would you describe him?
Well, he was a man. We know this. That I have in my files an absolute, a thorough analysis of Brown by a professional psychologist. He was a manic depressive, and about a third of his family were already locked up in various asylums. It ran in the family, but my favorite writer is Herman Melville. I'm an old Navy man, and I read Moby Dick while I was floating around the Pacific on an American cruiser in World War II. But I just worship Melville, and I came across this poem around when I was starting to write this book, a poem that he wrote about John Brown. And I can't really remember all the lines, but the last line is what really hit me between the eyes. He said... He described the atmosphere of doom and ominous growing hostility between the North and the South. And then the last line of the poem was, "And then there was Weird John Brown."
Yeah, weird.
That's about it. He was weird.
Willie in Madison has a question for you. Hi, Willie. Thank you for calling.
Hi. What I wanted to ask is, what influence did it have on Thomas Jefferson and many later slave owners, when they had the thing happen in Haiti? The U.S. has had an ongoing, for the last 200 and some years, malevolence toward Haiti, does only evil things to the Haitian people.
Yeah, so I agree with what you're saying about our attitude towards Haiti. That's a disease in the public mind of its own.
Yeah.
Go ahead, yeah.
Yeah.
I actually heard that it terrified Jefferson so much that he didn't even rape Sally Hemings for several months after it happened.
No. They didn't. He didn't rape her. If he did it, I hate to get into another completely different argument, but I wrote a book called The Intimate Lives of the Founding Fathers, and I spent a lot of time trying to decide whether there's any truth to that argument about Jefferson, the story about Jefferson and Sally. And I concluded that you can't prove it, but you can't disprove it either.
Yeah.
The stuff that was put out, that the DNA proved that Jefferson was the father, is absolute baloney. It's not so. It was not. It did not. It only proved that somebody who with the Jefferson DNA had fathered one or two of Sally's children, but it didn't mean that Thomas Jefferson did. And in the vicinity of Monticello, there was about 20 people of age, I might add, who had Jefferson DNA, including his younger brother, who used to come over to Monticello and play the fiddle late into the night while the slaves danced and played and drank. And there were two Frenchmen who lived at Monticello for a couple of years, refugees from the French Revolution, and they said that what went on at Monticello after sundown beat anything that they'd ever seen in any brothel in France.
Oh, man. We have not, and still have a few more minutes to go here, but we haven't talked about Robert E. Lee. You know, I always thought, well, not always, but I often thought that Robert E. Lee could well have turned out to be the President of the United States.
Larry, I will say you've read my mind right now, but you have indeed read my mind. I wrote an op-ed article. I think I published it in HNN, the History News Network. I published a lot of stuff there, but I said that very thing, that if Robert E. Lee had accepted Lincoln's offer to become the commander-in-chief of the Union Army as the South started to secede, there was a very strong likelihood that, A, Virginia would not have seceded, North Carolina, because they were the Virginia's like twin or something like that, psychologically and politically, they wouldn't have seceded, and that would have really demoralized the seceding states. And it's not at all impossible that the Civil War, instead of this great, awful Holocaust that it became, would have been a fairly bloody affair, maybe for 3 or 4 months, and then it would have been over, and Lee would have been the commander-in-chief presiding over the South, a Southerner presiding over the South, and it's not at all impossible that after Lincoln's second term, Robert E. Lee would have been the next president.
Isn't that, I've often thought that. What a difference, how things would have turned, that one decision.
Oh, it really, it's one of the great what-ifs, as I call it, that my friend Robert Cowley has written 3 books about the counterfactual look at American history, you know, and I've written an article for each one of them. And it's an amazing thought, what that is. And Lee, Cowley rather, Bob Rubb, as I call him, tried to get people to write about this. He went to a lot of professional historians. Nobody would touch it. It was too complicated. They said too explosive. They basically bugged out.
Well, I tell you, in the end, the real reason we fought the Civil War. What do you say?
What was the real reason?
Yeah,
it was a cumulative thing, a growing cumulative hatred between the North and the South, which could be tracked back to, for instance, things like Jefferson's embargo. In 1806, he embargoed all trade with the rest of the world to try to keep us at peace. It was an act of total political insanity, and he bankrupted half the businessmen in the North.
Yeah.
And this was a beginning of, in the North, of a hatred of the South for their contemptuous attitude towards the Northerners. And things like that, you know, that were very deeply involved in the growing antagonism that just built and built and built and until John Brown was the explosion that really set the match to the fire, you know.
Well, you have done a wonderful job of describing this, Thomas. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really enjoyed your book.
As you can see, I enjoy it. I think it's a really important subject that we shouldn't stop thinking about once this anniversary of the Civil War is over. There's a lot of thinking we ought to do about relationships between blacks and whites, and could we possibly resolve this in a way that would reconcile the two races. They still are not reconciled, I'm afraid, in my opinion. I try to end the book on a note of reconciliation, as you may recall. And Lincoln, with Lincoln saying there must be only a few days before he was assassinated, there must be a way that we can never use the word enemies again on either side.
Yeah, Thomas, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
It's been a real pleasure. Thomas Fleming, historian and historical novelist, has written A Disease in the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War. And, you know, it's particularly interest in this at this time of the year because here we are coming up on the 4th of July, and you might think, well, we should be talking about the revolutionary period of our U.S. history. Well, here, as we just learned, that the roots of the Civil War went back to our founding fathers in that revolutionary period. That got it started. Fascinating story. It was really great to have a chance to visit with him. Just a reminder, 3 weeks from today, July 22nd, that's at the same time, Jeff Shera is going to join us to talk about his new Civil War novel. It's called The Smoke at Dawn.